Well, we've got questions now for John D'Souza. How about also some of your own stories you can share with us? All of that is next when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. John D'Souza with us. Your phone calls as well. His book, The Paranormal Investigators. And, of course, you're working on the extra dimensionals as well, aren't you? Is that going to come out this year?
Yes, that'll be out in a few months. It's 52 True Tales and Concepts of Alien Visitors. It will be out soon in 2015.
You like that number, 52.
I don't know. You know what's funny is I don't even know why. It just came out that way. And it's like when people see 9/11 everywhere and every clock they look at.
Yep.
It's the same sort of thing with 52 for me. I don't know how that comes out.
Since you've been doing this, what has been for you the high point in your career?
The high point has been talking to someone that is just given some relief and support by hearing about other people that have had the same exact experience that they've had. There's a lot of loneliness when you feel that you have an experience that nobody else has had, that you're the only one, and it's never happened to anyone else. There's an experience that I've heard from many, many different variations of called the light voice, where an officer is caught in a desperate situation. He made a couple of bad decisions that came together, and then he's in a terrible, violent situation where he has no escape. And suddenly a cloud of light comes to him, to them, and tells them basically everything's going to be okay. And then it goes away. They get no further instructions. And then suddenly they know what to do to get out of the situation. And when these officers, they feel like this has only happened once. But then when they start to hear that that experience has happened to many other people in similar, very similar situations, it just kind of brings a great weight off their shoulders. And you can just see it when you let them know. It's a great feeling to be able to have someone that felt so alone and have them suddenly feel like they're sharing something in common with other comrades.
And in your travels of putting these stories together, did you come across any that you would think would be very sad?
Very sad?
Yeah.
Yeah, the saddest thing I've ever seen was the story of, it's basically the story of Richard Jewell, which some people might remember is an individual who
the security guard, the Atlanta bomber.
Yes.
Right, I remember.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was a person that, and a lot of this material, I believe, is still publicly available. There's actually videos of him that show him following an incredible procedure when he sees a package. He saw a package, a big backpack that was abandoned, suspicious package. But like a typical security guard, instead of being a typical security guard and just turning it in or asking a super, he immediately went into action. He set up a perimeter around the package. He told people to clear the area immediately. And then he basically is a person that just did everything. It took extraordinary process and followed procedures to an amazing degree. And he did some extraordinary things, and people weren't listening to him, and he started yelling at them to clear the area. Your lives are in danger. And eventually his efforts led to the fact that most people went to safety. It was the bomb exploded eventually, and there was only one person killed in the explosion and about 100 injured. If he hadn't done what he did,
it'll be the other way around.
Yes, it would have been 100 people dead instead of what happened.
He has passed on since, but didn't people look at him as a possible suspect for a while?
Yes, and if you look at the videos of him screaming at people to get out of the area, it becomes apparent that investigators looked at these videos over and over again, and something became apparent to them that'll become apparent to anyone who looks at these videos. And the fact is this. He knew it was a bomb. Then the question becomes, how does he know? How did he know it was a bomb? You see, and now material-based investigators concluded, well, the only way he could know it was a bomb is because he had to be involved somehow. And that's how all that started. And he became an object of suspicion, and it wrecked his life. I mean, it just tore him apart when he was first hailed as a great hero, which is what he was. But someone who's not rooted and I think some of these videos, I think they're still available on public sources, the videos of him just shouting at people to get to safety. But a person who looks at those same videos and is not necessarily rooted to only the material world can stretch their imagination and say he knew it was a bomb because he had some sort of ability to know it was a bomb, some sort of ability that was not just in the material world. And unfortunately, the people who were watching those videos and deciding about his life didn't have that ability to stretch that little bit and to think, you know, maybe he just has abilities that are not, that we just don't know about. And it was unfortunate because that's the chapter that I call Death by a Broken Heart, because he died so shortly after this was all resolved.
Yeah, he was young. He was in his 40s.
Oh, yes. He was very young. And, you know, the cause of death says diabetes, kidney, heart failure. But to this day, I still believe that he died of a broken heart from that experience.
Might have. That is sad. Let's go to the phones now. First-time caller, Ashley, driving in Fresno, California. Hey, Ashley, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for holding so long.
Hi. Well, basically, I'm trying to figure out where to start. My story is a long one as well, and first comment I want to make is that I'm not sure what's the guest name that you have on tonight.
His name is John D'Souza.
John, okay. I just want to say that John is saying is true because
Your phone is breaking up, but Tom, see if you can call her back directly and get a better connection since she's been on hold for such a long, long time. We're ready to get to the crux of what she wanted, John, but it's not meant to be.
Oh, that's too bad. It sounded like she had some interesting experience there in law enforcement.
Let's go to Chubbuck, Idaho. Dean's with us, so Dean, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. D'Souza, say, I'd like to get your take on, and this has been a great show, George.
Thank you.
Take on this chemtrail thing. It's been kicked around for so many years because George has had guests over the past that have said that they've been involved in the thing, and the only time the chemtrails broke up was when this well blew out down there in the Caribbean, and I guess they were using those planes to spray detergent, but hey, and following that, maybe you could kick around what the hell's going on in the Middle East on trying to put some of these oil producers out of business to drive the price up.
What do you think of conspiracy whistleblowers, John?
You know, I think that sometimes whistleblowers do save lives, and if that's what's at stake, then I think that they should do whatever they have to save people's lives. But however, short of that, I've seen so many of them pay so high a price for really a small return that sometimes I just feel like, you know, you have to support people who are fighting evil, absolutely. But I think that in a lot of cases, they just pay too high a price in exchange for the small portion of truth that they uncover. And these are people who are already, they could be great potential awakening teachers. To help people in general. And if they expend themselves on too small of a battlefield, then basically a lot of times what happens is they just get expended completely. And then they're not of any use in the greater fight for liberty that goes on all around them. You know, I just imagine what would have happened if David Icke, for instance, got involved in some major battle at BBC Sports Television early in his career and just went to the wall.
Who
with
knows?
That,
yeah.
Instead of what he's doing now. Or if Jim Mars, for instance, got involved in some great conflict at the New York Times or some other organization where he might have worked early on and just went to the wall on that, and then he wouldn't be doing, he may not be doing what he's doing today. So that's, I think whistleblowers can serve an important an important function, but I feel that in many cases they're just expending too much of themselves for too small of a return.
When you were with one of the three letter agencies, did you see things that you would have wanted to be a whistleblower on?
Did I? I would say no, because in things that go on in government that are things that we consider negative or wrong or corrupt, they tend to be managed from some high level, such high levels that we really, a lot of times, we don't really know where the ultimate authority is coming from. And so the people that we'd be going against in order to root out that sort of corruption, let's say, could be the wrong people. Like, for instance, the whole situation with disclosure, for instance. A lot of times people blame, they'll blame the president, they'll blame the Congress or the people who they believe are in charge for the lack of disclosure in terms of alien visitors. But the truth is, we really don't know what levels those decisions are coming from. I believe they're global. They're coming from a global level. And so a lot of times, if you wanna fight against corruption or against things going on that are wrong, you really don't want to be fighting the wrong people who are just don't even know what's going on.
Let's go to Dave in Nebraska. Welcome to the program, David. You're up with us.
Howdy. Great show.
Thanks,
Davey. And John, you're a wonderful subject. I just called in because I've been an investigator for almost 30 years, but through different capacity. I primarily centered on the last 20 years doing railroad crash investigations and or incidents, they call them, on the railroad side, just like those last three we had last month or, within the last 40 days down in the South. But I just had a couple stories I want to run by you as quick as I can.
Sure, go ahead.
I investigated an incident that happened in Wiggins, Colorado. That I live in North Platte. It's the largest rail yard in the world. And they run 140 trains a day out of this place, nice little place I live in. And it, of course, primarily railroad-oriented. But I started out, in order to do these investigations on just primarily railroad stuff, with working there 12 years before I went to what I really was intended to do, was the investigation of these broken wheels, broken axles, broken flat wheels, and all the things that cause accidents that aren't ever listed in the public. But this one at Wiggins involved a eastbound train coming out of Denver, and it ran into the back of another train, and it created like a 10-story pile of wreckage. And they had to figure out why that happened. And in the end, they blamed the train crew, the engineer and the conductor and the brakeman. And they said basically that, you were all asleep, even though it wasn't even nighttime, but they did. But it involved a signal. And where the paranormal comes in is that before the NTSB gets there, my phone rings and I'm on an airplane or in my Suburban and off to see, the situation. And so I get there early and have that access early, and therefore it makes it very interesting. I did interviews, all these things, and everyone that didn't get killed said that it was, the signals just quit working. And I thought, yeah. And then I went on to do a real investigation, which, in 20-some plus years, you become pretty good at it. And I knew that the guys that were still alive on that front end of the train said, absolutely had a green light. You know, every 2 miles, there's a block signal, they call them, on the railroads all over the country. And so that's what regulates speed and procedure within the next 6 miles. And this train ran just straight into the back of another train out there. And So it was a puzzle to me. Long story short, the NTSB pulled out and after about 6 days. And then everyone else, you know, was going to label it crew failure. But I stayed around for another 2 weeks, and I found a little trailer court right across the tracks. I mean, within 200 yards. And this little old gal, because I went to every trailer, this little old gal told me, well, I was up all night and up all day, and I just saw it all happen, you know. And I told her, well, what do you think happened? And she said, and I stood in her kitchen looking out her kitchen window, and I saw the signal operate and not, you know, or change, you know, under different train speeds that the trains kept going by. And I noticed that.
David, I've got to speed you up, David. We're almost out of time.
All right. Thanks. Anyway, I found out that that signal actually was had its mind of its own. And so I went out there and recorded it and watched it and found out that I fully believe that there were paranormal things going on with it. And it caused these trains to collide. I turned it all in to the proper authorities and everything, and they changed. The NTSB changed their whole ruling.
See, that sounds evil to me.
Were you able to destroy that signal? I wonder if he was able to destroy that signal eventually. So it wouldn't commit the same heinous.
You know, I don't think it was the signal that did it. There must have been some kind of evil apparition that controlled it. Don't you think?
Yeah, it could very well be that. But it's very interesting when you talk to investigators who have reached an investigative conclusion at the end of everything that they do that involves a paranormal element, because it's always unwelcome news. Because authorities want to open these things and then they want to close them. And if they have to blame a bunch of guys who are awake and say that they were sleeping, then they want to do that. They don't want to deal with complications. And paranormal is a huge complication in investigations, like this gentleman just made clear to us.
All right. We're going to come back and take some final phone calls and wrap things up in just a moment. Right here on Coast to Coast AM, as we are dealing with John D'Souza, the para investigators. On our next Coast to Coast program, Rebecca Roth joins us. She has an incredible story about the events of 9/11 based on her experiences in the airline industry. So don't miss that program. And on Friday, of course, we're going to be talking about haunted bookstores and libraries, and of course, then those Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines. Okay, welcome back with our guest, John D'Souza, as we talk about his work, The Para Investigators. John, when you were putting the book together, did you encounter any roadblocks?
Roadblocks, I would say, is mostly people who wanted to make sure that they had their anonymity preserved, because some of the stories that they were able to share are stories where they may not have been in the best portrayed in the most heroic light. So some people would be extra cautious about sharing certain things when they wanted to be certain that their identities would be protected during the telling of the tale. That was the only part that had to really be smoothed over with people at times and had to give a lot of reassurances to get past that point.
You've talked a little bit about the trolls and elves. Tell me a little bit about that. You've got a couple little chapters about
The trolls and elves are basically something that was explained to me by a very well-known criminal who basically told me that Chosen L's are two sides of a very similar coin. They're basically people that appear human, and this was basically the theory that a serial killer explained to me. He basically told me that there were humans who appear human, but they're not. They're really a different sort of species, and he used the analogy of trolls and elves. He said they're races that have a higher degree of energy than regular humans. And he said the ones that use that light and that energy for positive things, to build businesses, to build charities and good things for people, those are elves. He says they have positive energy, white light. He says the trolls are the ones who become sort of these super criminals. They're people who use that extra reservoir of energy, that extra fountain, I should say, of energy for nefarious purposes, always for evil. And he said to me, one of the strange things about these trolls and elves, these alternate races, as he would put it, is that basically a troll could become an elf. They could become somebody who uses all that excess energy for positive things, or an elf could just turn evil and become a troll, but that neither of these races would just become regular humans again. And so it was really an interesting thesis, and he had an entire theory behind it, and he had a lot of explanation of details of how the process works and about who fits into what category. But it was very fascinating. It was very fascinating.
Would you say, John, you're spiritual?
Yes, very much so. Very spiritual, and I really feel that people's paranormal beliefs are a continuing part of that hyper-spiritual spectrum that goes all the way from individual spirituality, paranormal beliefs, even religiosity. I think all those things are part of the same sort of spectrum. I believe very firmly in God. I feel that all throughout my life I've benefited from a large measure of protection, white light sort of protection, and it has always helped me at all times, especially in dealing with the paranormal, which does have its negative parts.
It does. Let's go to Las Vegas. Cynthia's with us, west of the Rockies. Cynthia, take it away.
Hi, George. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Great. Good to have you
John,
with us.
A great show, by the way. John, I'm calling because you hit on a few notes that I have a question about. I'm just going to throw this out there. I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, but I traveled all over the world. I'm an anthropologist. So, basically science. And I have a issue that I do that I have no name for it. And I've been doing it since I was about 7 years old. I'm 59 years old now. It's like I can see people 29 days before they die. They start to fade. I don't know if you're familiar with this phenomenon. I don't know what it's called. I've tried to find out. I mean, it's not clairvoyance. It's not clairaudience, as far as I understand. It's not even, you know, being empathic. Because when I look at a person, either in my family or where I work or if I'm working in another country or whatever, and everything else is crisp around them, but they start to blur out like they're through a filter. I know, and this happens every time. It has never, and I was never raised as, my mother and my father never told me, no, that isn't true, but it's like I can expect somebody to die, even if I don't know them. But I can actually document it with people that I do know, and it could be natural causes, it could be an accident, it could be a disease they didn't know about. There's so many ways they go, but they go on from the time I see them start to fade. Have you ever heard of anything like that? And I can take this answer off the air if that would help.
Wow. I have never heard of that phenomena, but I wonder if you always tell the person. I wonder if the caller always tells the person when that event occurs. Does she reveal it to them? Does she withhold it from them? Does she just document it and then see if it comes true? I would suspect that she probably doesn't reveal it to them. and that she holds on to the information because it would just be too traumatic for her to share that. She probably just documents it for her own purposes so she can prove later that this did happen. But yeah, that's a really shocking ability to have and to know.
Did you ever come across any stories, John, of ghostly hitchhikers or anything like that?
I came across, like I told you, my first story that I was ever told by an officer was similar along the lines of a roadside type story. And I haven't collected the hitchhiker stories are so common.
Oh, they're bizarre.
They're everywhere, and they happen so much, and with people that will be able to document, they'll pick up the hitchhiker, they'll go, you know, and I'm sure this happens to a lot of officers because they have the natural inclination to help someone in trouble, and they'll be able, and I'm sure that they pick up these hitchhikers who later turn out to be non-people and people who did not exist, and they later are able to document that it's an individual who died. And those stories are so common, and it's so people who I believe don't know that they're dead and or are unwilling to accept that it's time for them to move on, and they spend some time on these highways getting rides from people to see where they can go to. I think they're trying to go to a better place, but instead of accepting that they're dead and going to a better place, I think they're trying to take a ride to a better place.
John, did you ever hear stories of people involved in what should have been a major car accident, collision head-on? They seem to just mesh between themselves and come out without anybody getting hit at all. They just kind of like, you know, just disintegrate, and then they reappear.
I have heard and been told personal stories of people, usually women for some reason, who are in car accidents where the car basically disintegrates around them, and somehow they come out without a scratch.
Yeah, it dematerializes and then it pops back up again.
Oh, that particular brand I have not come across. I have seen pictures of cars that were crumpled up into the size of like shoe boxes.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we've seen those. But I mean, these are where people, they're coming right at each other, they look at each other, it's panic.
Yeah.
And then the cars just dematerialize.
Wow. That would be really interesting to track down the documentation on that sort of thing. Although I have seen videos that appeared to be unaltered of somebody going headlong into a truck with their car and then somehow ending up behind it.
Let's go to Long Island, New York. It's Michael Stern. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, George. Thank you for having me on. I love your show.
Thank you.
And, you know, paranormal, that's the wrong word. It's real. And I just wanted to share a short story. I am a security guard. This facility is closed. There are no cars in the parking field. And last fall, at about 2 in the morning, I could hear two women having a conversation very loud. And I knew it was the other side. And I just asked them, please quiet down. And they did. So it's real.
Wow. Yeah, I like the saying, the new normal is paranormal. I like that saying because, yeah, he's right. It is real, and it's as real as it's sometimes it becomes more real than what we consider real time and space here. And it's just it's very nice that those ladies from the other side were so considerate that they actually quieted down for him when he asked them to. That was very, very nice and courteous of them. And so courtesy still exists even on the other side of reality. I'm glad to hear that.
All right, let's take a few more calls here, time permitting. Joe, North Carolina, first-time caller. Joseph, hi, Joe.
Hi, Joe. Oh, hi, how are you doing?
Good. Well, that one's not going to work. Joe, we got to get a better phone there for you. Let's go to George in Kansas, east of the Rockies. Hey, George, go ahead.
Yes, George and John, we respect you. How you doing?
Great, George. Thank you.
Have you ever heard of the Twisted Hairs?
I have not. What is that?
Oh, they're shamans. They're a consortium that's been on the planet for many, many moons, and there is a paranormal event that is afoot that's about to take place to assist brothers and sisters in the animal kingdom up in the Arctic area with bringing that weather back to that area and to bring balance back to that area. And it's based upon the mind. Shamans, of course, have their feet in both worlds. And this paranormal event will be a joint event, a joint mindset between or among all the shamans that are on the planet with the assistance of four great spirits who control the weather of the planet. So it's sort of like the 100th monkey effect. And the shamans are currently working on a psychic level to bring about an event which will probably start on the next full moon. I didn't know if you were aware of things that like this that are going on the planet.
What the Twisted Hairs, what tribe are they?
They consist of shamans from all different tribes across the planet. They've been together for thousands of years.
Hmm.
That is something. The next full moon, I have to look up when it is. But
well, we've got another interesting blood moon coming up.
Oh yeah, that's coming up. I think on April 4th, and but we have an eclipse even before
eclipse
that.
Eclipse coming, and the equinox is about ready to pop on us. Lots going on out there.
Oh yeah, very very.
Any cemetery stories, John?
Cemetery stories, I have not really come across. I find that a morphogenic energy site can be anywhere. I mean, I have come across places like buildings, public institutions. Another place that very often has restless spirits are prisons, large prisons, even if they're still being operated. Everybody knows about abandoned prisons, but even prisons that are still operating very often have very restless spirits and corners here and there and in library areas. I find those places to be extremely active and sometimes pretty frightening to the people who have to work in those places.
Kathy in Oklahoma City. Hi, Kathy. It's your turn.
Hi, Kat. I mean, hi, George. Thank you so much. Sure. I've been listening since the Hail Bob Heaven's Gate days.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And, you know, I go way back. Okay. Your guest, after 9/11, there were guests that talked about people who had precognition.
Yes.
But tonight, your guest said some very specific things about children, their nightmares, dreams, visions, and drawings, and also the police officer who said he had the same dream as the little boy with the phone in the middle of the room and calling from the guy calling from the office on the 77th floor, which was later proven to be true. Remember, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to give you a short confirmation. You're both familiar with this. This is a 2,500-year-old prophecy. It's at the end times. Your sons and I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And then it says that I will show wonders in heavens and in the earth, blood and fire, pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. And these visions and dreams and stuff, see, I was raised, children should be seen and not heard, because my dad was raised in English boarding schools and was a Marine. Well, when my son was born, my philosophy is his thoughts and feelings and words are just as valid as any adult's. And he also has Asperger's syndrome. And if you know anything about that, it's like smart autistic. And so I've always listened to him, and he used to mesmerize me. Now, he's 17 now, so he's growing out of it. You know, he's a little slow on this puberty thing here, but, you know, he loves video games.
He'll get there. He'll get there. No rush.
But you know what I'm saying? What I'm saying, like, oh, I don't want to rush. Trust me, he's my only baby. But when he was young, he would say things. He even told me a story, I'm going to say it as fast as I can, where...
Only got 30 seconds for you.
I'll say it in 30 seconds. When he was 3 or 4 years old, he was having a dream. He was taken up to heaven by angels. He got to sit on the lap of Jesus. Now, I grew up in church. I was raised in church. I never taught my child anything about the Bible. I feel bad about that. I'm teaching him now. Okay, so in the dream or vision, he's on the lap of Jesus. He sees Jesus, God, whatever, all everything up in heaven. And then he tells Jesus that he has to go back because his parents are getting ready to wake up. And if he's dead or asleep or gone when we wake up, we'll panic and we'll cry. And then he said he was sent back and he woke up.
Wow.
And he was 4 years old. And he's three, and he still remembers.
All right, there's your 30 seconds. Great story there. Many, you could write another book, John.
Yeah, just with her, I think.
You got that right. Hey, thanks for being on the program. Keep in touch. Let me know when the Alien book is done, too, okay?
Absolutely, George. Thank you so much for having me on.
John D'Souza, the name of the book, The Paranormal Investigators. I love it. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.